I next met with Dr. Stephen Gore of Yale University. To begin, he commented on the global perception of MDS as a disease.
I think that one of the misconceptions that hematologists brought upon ourselves over the years that I think continues to confuse both patients and their physicians is that for many years, hematologists were highly invested in insisting that myelodysplastic syndromes were not cancer, that they were pre-malignancies. And it's kind of odd and ironic to think about it because nobody ever had any problem calling chronic myeloid leukemia a malignancy, even though it has functional hematopoiesis and eventuates in something that resembles an acute leukemia if untreated. Similarly, nobody ever had any problem calling chronic lymphocytic leukemia cancer. But over the years, myelodysplastic syndrome was considered a premalignant lesion. We know that, of course, now not to be the case. It meets all the criteria for neoplasm, clonal identity of the cells, dysfunction of the cells, and aberrant regulation and progression. So that meets all the criteria for neoplasms. And I think it's important to be honest with patients right from the get-go. If we're not honest with patients about the fact that they have a leukemia, which is going to be progressive, they spend all their time worrying about, do I have leukemia today? And that's what physicians tend to focus on too. And well, they don't have leukemia yet. And it's really, I think, getting the dialogue with the patient as well as our treatment goals off to the wrong foot. So I think it's important to recognize that MDS is a clonal neoplasm of progenitor and stem cells. And, you know, I think most of our audience are familiar in general with the clinical presentation that the marrows tend to have too many cells and the blood tends to have too few cells. And that's because the cells which are being made in the marrow are dysfunctional and tend to die due to apoptosis or programmed cell death. And they also may have the property of not behaving well as mature blood cells. That is to say, some people who have adequate numbers of neutrophils may still be prone to infections, although I think we overplay that some. But certainly some people who have adequate numbers of platelets may still have bruising and bleeding problems. And the third point that I would make here is that myelodysplastic syndrome is really syndromes. That's a highly heterogeneous group of diseases with a variable natural history.
Very naive question. It's funny because this issue about that it's really leukemia and really cancer, you know, has come up for so many years. Has anybody actually thought about changing the name of it?
I mean, well, you know, that's one of my soapboxes.
Not just you. I mean, a lot of people say that.
Yeah, you know, for me, the issue is not whether we should change the name of myelodysplastic syndrome, but we should never change the name to acute myeloid leukemia. That's where the confusion is. Of course, this has always been an arbitrary cutoff. At some point in the way years ago, it was something like 50% blasts. When I was growing up as a resident, it was 30% blasts, and as a fellow and even as an attending physician. And then, of course, the WHO classification in 2001 decreased the threshold for changing the name to acute myeloid leukemia. And in parallel to the fact that we don't call CML and blast crisis, we don't call it acute myeloid leukemia because we recognize that biologically it's different. If it were up to me, we wouldn't call the advanced phase of MDS AML either, again, because I think it's misleading.
Do you want to comment on the prognostic scoring system?
There has been a variety or a sequence of prognostic scoring systems which have been utilized since about 1997 when the first international prognostic scoring system was developed. I think, unfortunately, many people are still using the IPSS, the original IPSS, and many clinical trials are still falling back on the IPSS, and I think that that's quite unfortunate because the IPSS, you know, gives limited information. The four groups are really quite heterogeneous. So the IPSS has been displaced in large part by the revised IPSS, or the IPSSR. And in contrast to the IPSS, which I believe had three cytogenetic groupings in terms of risk categories, the revised IPSS has five. It stratifies the percentage of bone marrow blasts into four different groupings, and it gives points for different levels of cytopenias. It's really a very complicated system to apply. I have to use an app on my phone. I can usually do the IPSS more or less, the traditional one, in my head. But I do use a phone app for the IPSSR. And, of course, the IPSSR leads to assignment of patients to one of five risk groups, a very high-risk group, a very low-risk group, a high-risk group, which is less than very high, a low-risk group, which is less than very low, and intermediate risk group. And again, I think this is important information for patients. Now, the less commonly used, but still pretty more or less up-to-date prognostic scoring system is the WHO prognostic scoring system, or the WPSS, which predated the IPSSR, and which was developed by Malcovati and Cazzola and others in Europe. It's a much easier system, which is why I like to use it, but it requires a very good hematopathologist because it weighs heavily on having an accurate WHO categorization of the MDS. The reason I like the WPSS scoring system is that it was developed statistically as a dynamic scoring system over time so that a patient can have a WPSS score assigned at any time in their diagnosis, and it can change throughout the diagnosis, whereas the IPSS and the IPSSR statistically were modeled just at presentation and are really static systems that are not meant to be reapplied. Now, there have been some retrospective studies testing the IPSSR over time, and in fact, it's probably close enough. But interestingly, Neil, when I see patients, I usually calculate both the WPSS and the IPSSR, both on a phone app, and they almost always come out exactly the same, which I think biologically is pretty interesting because it suggests that the WHO pathology system really integrates a lot of the biology, which is manifested in the IPSSR as cytogenetics and in these various degrees of cytopenias. There's a lot of wisdom in a very good pathologist. It's kind of back to the old days in some ways. And I also find that it's useful because when I find that there's a discrepancy between the IPSSR score and the WPSS score, it usually means there's something going on, which I uncover when I do mutational analysis in that patient.
Could I just clarify, though, for a oncologist and community-based practice, a general medical oncology practice, in a non-research situation,
sure.
What do they need to do or know? Is this relevant, for example?
Well, I think it's highly relevant because when one's seeing a patient with MDS, one needs to assess what's the global natural history outlook for this patient. And one needs to know, although I think probably all such patients should be seen at a center of excellence by somebody who really knows the field, because it is quite a complicated field, at least once they should see such a referring physician, a specialist physician, subspecialist. I think it's very important for the general hematologist or oncologist to be able to, on a first-pass analysis, understand that this is a disease where we've got some time to get the referral in, to think about what our plans are, or this is a disease that's likely to get worse fast and to get the patient headed in the right direction. Is this a disease that we're going to be approaching with stem cell transplant anytime in the near future or down the road? So I think it's really quite important that physicians in practice at least get comfortable with one of these up-to-date scoring systems to be able to help prognosticate for their patients and counsel their patients.
Any comments about, you know, this comes up literally every single kind of cancer, which is the spectrum of mutations. What do we know about the spectrum of mutations with MDS that are seen?
Right, well, this is increasingly important, and the first major study in MDS that looked at this was from Rafa Behar and colleagues. When Dr. Behar was a fellow, I think, at the Dana-Farber, he's now an independent investigator at the University of California in San Diego. And they looked at approximately 12 or so genes that were known to be commonly mutated in MDS and looked at their frequency and the frequency of co-mutation analysis, as well as prognostication. And they found for certain genes, P53 mutations, for example, ASXL1 are two that stick out in my mind right now, and there are several others, RUNX1 as well, I believe, they impact the prognostic scoring system so that for a patient who, in the old IPSS system, which is they were still using, a patient who has one of these mutations gets moved down a notch prognostically. So if you're in a low-risk group and you have a high-risk mutation, you move down into the next higher-risk category. Now, that hasn't been integrated into the IPSSR or the WPSS at this point. So in some ways, it's really another piece of information, which, again, for me, helps tip me. In one of the cases we may talk about, is one of these rare instances where the IPSSR and the WPSS didn't match. One was worse than the other. And the reason was, well, it's not the reason was, but upon doing the mutational analysis, in fact, this patient did have gene mutations which favored the less favorable, which gave more credence to the less favorable prognostic scoring system. So I think the mutational analysis is important. Nowadays, we certainly know that things like P53 mutations mitigate against a favorable outcome with stem cell transplant. That's something we need to know when we counsel our patients. So I use the mutational analysis sort of as an adjunctive diagnostic tool, prognostic tool. Now, the mutational analyses can also be very important in the situations where it's difficult to nail down a diagnosis of myelodysplastic syndrome. The pathologists feel that the dysplasia isn't present in enough cells, or the changes are too subtle, and the cytogenetic analysis is normal karyotype, and you don't even know if you've got a clonal abnormality. And there, I think it's really important. If you find a clonal abnormality, at least it gets us on the right page that we're dealing with a primary bone marrow disorder. And then, of course, that can get us into the complicated question about the new field, about clonal abnormalities, clonal hematopoietic abnormalities of indeterminate significance, the MGUS of myelodysplastic syndrome, if you will, but we can talk about that later, perhaps.
Are any of these mutations, quote, driver mutations? I don't recognize any of them. Anything that's targetable in MDS?
No, they're not targetable, but they are certainly driver mutations. They're not driver mutations in the sense that they're not tyrosine kinases that can be easily targeted, but they're mostly transcription factors, which do drive the disease. They're abnormal transcription factors.
Can you comment a little bit about the goals of therapy that you think about when you see a patient with MDS?
Right. I think it's very important when we see a new patient with MDS and we're telling them about their disease to understand and to share with them, or have a dialogue, even better, with them about their goals of care. Because like most cancers, we can talk about treatments which are palliative, which are intended to improve blood counts and quality of life, and which may therefore also be associated with improved survival, because obviously patients who are profoundly anemic are going to survive longer if we transfuse them, for example, or find another way to get their hemoglobin higher, or whether our treatment is going to really have curative intent, which for the most part with this set of diseases is going to at some point involve an allogeneic stem cell transplant. And, you know, patients are surprisingly all over the board about their response to the risks and benefits of stem cell transplant. You know, as I get older and have spent more years seeing patients, I've always assumed that patients of a certain age and health would automatically want to defer to, you know, potentially curative therapy, and that patients who are much older might not. And the longer I'm in practice, the more heterogeneous is the population that I see, which of course makes sense. So there are younger people who are unwilling sometimes to take the risk of a stem cell transplant, given the likelihood of cure that we can quote to them. And similarly, there, or in contrast, there are many patients in their later 70s who are upset if they're being told they are probably not good candidates for stem cell transplant because of their age.
Maybe you can comment a little bit about your own sort of treatment algorithm.
So the first and overriding question is this a patient who should be considered for curative therapy at some point in the guise of a stem cell transplant? And that has to do, of course, with comorbidities. It has to do with age. It used to have a lot to do with donor availability, but now that we've got all sorts of alternative donor transplantation, including haploidentical transplantation, most patients will potentially have a donor. And of course, in many centers will transplant patients who are healthy up to and over the age of 75. So age is less of a mitigating factor than it used to be. And so then we really get into the question of patient philosophy and approach their lives. And we have to be realistic, because for most MDS cases for whom we offer transplant, that is to say patients who tend to have more advanced or advancing disease, our most honest estimates of cure rate is about 30%, maybe 30 to 40% on a good day. So depending on the age of the patient and comorbidities, if you're offering a therapy that may have a 15 to 30% mortality rate, again, depending on a lot of clinical factors, versus a 30% cure rate, you can see why patients are circumspect about that choice. But at any rate, I do think that that's an overriding question that one needs to ask to assess and to engage the patient in, because I do think that drives our therapies to some extent. We then use a scoring system one of the more current prognosticating systems, but basically put people into a higher risk category and a lower risk category. They're in a lower risk category, for the most part, our immediate goals are palliative, improving quality of life, improving blood counts, maintaining quality of life. If they're in a higher risk category, we're talking about disease modifying therapies. So taking the latter, our disease modifying therapies are really based on azanucleosides at this point, either azacitidine or decitabine, and there are others which are in development, but the two FDA-approved drugs are azacitidine and decitabine for higher-risk MDS. And we know, at least from clinical trials of azacitidine, that in general, early application of azacitidine to higher-risk patients is associated with improved survival compared to waiting and adding it on later. But in my view, starting an azanucleoside should be associated with planning for stem cell transplant if the patient's going that way. I think one of the bigger mistakes that is made in the community, well, what I would consider a mistake, is having a patient go on azacitidine or decitabine, have a great response, and then decide to either stop the azanucleoside, which we know to be doomed to failure because recurrence will happen usually quite rapidly, or continue treating with the azanucleoside until the patient breaks through, the disease breaks through, in which case very few patients will be salvageable. So if one is going to offer the patient stem cell transplant, the time to be planning it is when they're getting their azanucleoside and hopefully have a good response. That's the time to move to transplant, kind of ironically. Anyway, that's the disease-altering approach. In the palliative approach, it really depends on the needs of the patient in terms of cytopenias. So if the problem is primarily anemia, one wants to find a way to mitigate the anemia. And the first question we ask is whether there's a utility to erythropoietic stimulating agents. Again, this is for lower risk MDS. And the question there is based on the serum erythropoietin level. And that's, again, a test which many practitioners forget to or neglect to order. But we know that patients whose endogenous erythropoietin level is high, certainly above 500, but I would say even above 200, they're highly unlikely to respond to erythropoietic stimulating agent, either erythropoietin or darbepoietin. Whereas if their erythropoietin level is low, particularly less than 200, and they're anemic, they are likely to respond to exogenous administration of growth factors. And the caveat there is that for patients who have ringed sideroblasts who are being offered erythropoietin as opposed to darbepoietin, many or most of those patients will require the addition of G-CSF to get an erythroid response. So is the patient a candidate for erythropoietic stimulating agents? That's an important question. In the subset of patients who have low-risk myelodysplastic syndrome with a 5Q minus, or a deletion of 5Q, we know that there's a very high response rate to lenalidomide, with about 65 or 70% becoming transfusion independent in response to lenalidomide as a single agent. There's disagreement among experts as to whether patients in such a category who also have low erythropoietin levels deserve a trial of an erythropoietic stimulating agent first, or whether they should just go to lenalidomide. My personal practice is to give the ESA first, and if they respond to that, ride that out and save the lenalidomide for when the ESA is no longer working. But I know I have colleagues whom I respect who go straight to lenalidomide. And then there is a subset of patients who will respond to immunosuppressive therapy. And the problem is, and it's maybe as high as 30% of these patients, but the problem is that there are no good predictive schemata that reliably allow us to choose the patients who are likely to respond to immunosuppressive therapies, in particular antithymocyte globulin, which of course is a big deal to give to patients. So I don't know how to pick those patients out. It's often thought that patients with the subset of MDS, which is hypocellular, are perhaps more likely to respond to immunosuppressive therapies. And in such a patient, I have been known to initiate immunosuppressive therapy, which I'll usually start with cyclosporin myself, but that's just my personal practice.
Oh, I actually want to go with this algorithm, move from this to your cases, but just a couple of follow-up questions, and I think it's going to come out with the cases also. Going back to the issue of the patient with a 5Q minus, what do you do when the patient has progression on the lenalidomide?
Well, that's really an important question, and such a patient is likely to be moved to a DNA methyltransferase inhibitor, an azanucleoside. How often that is going to be active in that situation is not so clear. As a matter of fact, it's a subject that one of my colleagues here at Yale, Thomas Prébet, is currently putting together a publication about a retrospective analysis of multi-international data set of what happens to patients following lenalidomide failure, either primary or secondarily. But the outcome for such patients is often not terribly good. So they need to be probably thought of as a higher risk group of patients and be put into more of a high risk algorithm.
What about pomalidomide or other IMIDs?
Yeah, pomalidomide isn't active. And we think we know the reason for that based on Ben Ebert's really spectacular work from the Dana-Farber about the mechanism of IMID activity in a variety of diseases through their protein receptor for the IMIDs, which is called cereblon. And all the IMIDs bind to cereblon, but depending on the cell type, cereblon, when engaged, the cell type in the IMID, cereblon in the IMID will recruit a variety of transcription factors and ubiquitination of the transcription factor and degradation of the transcription factor. So depending on which transcription factor to which that particular cancer is addicted, one IMID may work in one disease and not another. So pomalidomide does not lead to degradation of casein kinase 1, which is the culprit here, we think, at least in part, in 5q- MDS, whereas lenalidomide does lead to degradation of casein kinase 1. And that's why pomalidomide is not active. It's really pretty fascinating. There are companies active in developing new generations of cereblon interacting drugs, which you might call IMIDs, specifically targeting specific transcription factors. So I think it's pretty cool that hopefully that mechanism may be used to target other transcription factors in the future.
That is really cool. Also about this algorithm, where, if at all, does lenalidomide fit in non-5q minus disease?
You know, I leave it out because it's not a huge part of my practice. But we do know that lenalidomide has a palliative benefit in terms of red cell improvement in about 25% of patients. And it's quite reassuring that the early data that was in an earlier trial published by Dr. Azaraza, which said that the number was 25%, was subsequently identically replicated in a larger phase 3 study run in Europe. I think it was called MDS-005, published by Valeria Santini from Firenze, Italy, which again shows the exact 25%, totally different era, like 10 years later, against placebo. So 25% of low-risk MDS who don't have 5q minus do respond to lenalidomide. We don't have a molecular profile for those patients, but it's certainly a reasonable thing to consider for the anemia-only low-risk MDS patient. We do know that if your platelets are lower, you're less likely to respond. Patients who responded in Dr. Raza's study had a median platelet number of something like 150,000. It was really quite high for this population. That's one piece. And now there are two studies, which one from France and one from the Eastern Cooperative Oncology Group, led by Alan List, actually, for Moffitt, which randomly looked at lenalidomide alone versus lenalidomide in conjunction with an erythropoietic stimulating agent. I think in both cases it might have been erythropoietin, although I'm not sure if the French study allowed darbepoetin as well. I think it might have. But both studies suggested that the combination of lenalidomide with the erythropoietic stimulating agent was more successful in reducing transfusion or leading to transfusion independence than the lenalidomide alone. So I think that's going to become the standard of care if one's going to try that approach.
Okay, so why don't we go through a few of these cases? Why don't we start out with your 79-year-old lady?
So this case is that of an elderly woman in pretty good shape, a 79-year-old woman. Her main active problem is polyarthritis, which is considered to be rheumatoid arthritis. She has a prior history of endometrial cancer and assorted other things like hypertension and compression fractures. And she presented with chronic anemia. Of course, she has active rheumatoid arthritis. She's being treated at the time with methotrexate and prednisone. She's had Enbrel in the past. So the question was whether she really had myelodysplastic syndrome or whether she really had anemia of chronic inflammatory disease. And she was otherwise really quite a healthy woman and had a bone marrow done because we felt that it was important to clarify what was going on. Her counts were otherwise, I think, pretty normal. And in fact, her bone marrow showed a myelodysplastic syndrome, low-grade myelodysplastic syndrome, with an isolated deletion of the long arm of chromosome 5, or DEL5Q. And interestingly, morphologically, she had characteristic smog megakaryocytes associated with the 5Q-minus syndrome. At that time, her hemoglobin was about 9.2. She was macrocytic with an MCV of 126, but her Y count was normal, and platelet count, as I mentioned, about 300,000.
Could I just ask, is it possible this is some type of secondary MDS to her RA medications? And I don't even know methotrexate. I mean, it's not an alkylating agent, but you tell me.
Well, you know, that's a fascinating question, Neil. So methotrexate definitely can cause therapy-related myeloid neoplasm. And we don't know so much about the disease-modifying treatments for RA, but there's a suspicion that there may be some risk there as well. But for sure, methotrexate, 6-MP, azathioprine, are associated with secondary MDS. And in the old days, thought of 5Q minus MDS, not DEL5, not 5Q minus syndrome, but cytogenetics, which include deletion of chromosome 5 and monosomies of 5, as being typical, certainly, of alkylating agent-induced MDS, but they don't tend to be the 5Q minus syndrome. So, you know, we've got an older woman, which is the traditional presentation for 5Q minus syndrome. So, you know, I think one can ask the question, but I don't know. I don't know the answer.
For practical purposes, does it really matter whether it's secondary MDS in general? Does it change what you do?
No, that's a really great question, Neil. What we know now is that prognostic factor for prognostic factor, that is to say, matching up the prognostic factors for a therapy-related myeloid neoplasm compared to the theoretically de novo or presentation of a similar myeloid neoplasm with the same features, their outcomes are likely to be the same. And that's true for therapy-related AML, which is now lumped together, as you probably know, with therapy-related MDS as therapy-related myeloid neoplasm.
So I see that this lady received lenalidomide on a clinical trial.
Nicely for our patients with 5Q, with DEL5Q syndrome, the ECOG study that I was mentioning that Alan List ran, 2905, was really a study to randomly look at the impact of the addition of ESA or not to lenalidomide. But for patients who had DEL5Q, they were just assigned to get lenalidomide alone and got the drug for free. So while there wasn't a lot of science to be done there outside of whatever Alan may be doing in his lab with the samples, these patients got easy access to lenalidomide. So it was nice to put them on the trial, and she did. And she had a really robust hemoglobin response to a hemoglobin of 12, but she really did not like being on the lenalidomide.
What was the dose?
Well, the study started at 10 for all patients. I believe that we needed to drop her dose because the cytopenia is to 5. I don't remember whether she ever went down to 5 every other day or not.
But she didn't like the lenalidomide? She had some side effects?
She just had kind of fatigue and didn't like it. She didn't feel great. Even though her hemoglobin was great, she wasn't feeling any better than when she started. So she decided to go off the study, and I couldn't argue with her. At that time, her hemoglobin, which had come up to 12, had started to go back down. So we were a little worried about whether this was evidence of her breaking through the lenalidomide. But again, from a clinical PEARLS point of view, it is known that patients who are on lenalidomide and having a robust response, sometimes at that point, the lenalidomide does inhibit the erythropoiesis. So you sometimes have to give them a drug holiday or go down in the dose. Or the study would have asked actually to add an ESA at that time, but she was going to have no part of it. She really didn't like it. And I have to say, personally, I felt a little bad because I felt like somehow I'd let her down. But she agreed to come in for her follow-up visit 3 months later for the study, and she did. And interestingly, 3 months off of the lenalidomide, her hemoglobin had come back up to 12, and she felt like a million bucks. We tested her peripheral blood FISH for 5Q minus, and she had zero evidence in her blood of 5Q minus cells. And it's now been a year off lenalidomide. She maintains a hemoglobin of 12. I just saw her yesterday, actually. Feels like a million bucks. And as of last month, had no evidence of 5Q minus deletion in her blood. So she had a really remarkable response. We never assess whether she's in a bone marrow complete response, but certainly in peripheral blood, she's in a complete response that's been maintained now almost a year, or at least a half a year now, off lenalidomide. So good for her.
That is fascinating. What is known about unmaintained responses to lenalidomide with 5Q?
Not so much, because, you know, our recommendation has been to continue until progression. And we know that based on those studies, the median duration of response in a complete responder is something like 3 to 4 years. But at least I don't at the top of my fingertips have any data on patients who came off for various reasons, but that's something we probably should look at.
What a fascinating case. I mean, maybe she was cured.
Well, I don't think that she's cured, but I think, you know, it'll be great if she has a robust response for some time. And I think it's likely that she'll re-respond to lenalidomide if she allows us to put her back on it, should she recur.
Well, she's 79. I guess she'll be cured if she died of something else.
Well, she's pretty robust, so we're hoping she can get another decade or two under her belt.
Yeah, and statistically, if you could get rid of this, maybe she would. Let's hear about your 59-year-old man.
Right. This is a guy that I'm currently treating as well. He's currently 60. He was 59 when I saw him last summer. And he's an engineer, robust guy. He had gone on a health and weight loss program last year, lost about 25 pounds intentionally, really quite fit physically. And, you know, his employer sends him for yearly physicals, and he went and was found to have cytopenias that led to an unfortunate diagnosis of MDS versus chronic myelomonocytic leukemia. He's, depending on which marrow you look at and which blood counts, one can make the case for either a refractory anemia with XSPLAS2 versus CMML2. But in either event, it was a pretty significant high-grade MDS. And he was sent to one of my colleagues for consideration for allogeneic stem cell transplant, who recognized that while this is a young guy who needs a stem cell transplant, he was in no shape for a stem cell transplant at that point in terms of his bone marrow. He needed to be brought into better control of his disease for the stem cell transplant to be effective. So he was really totally asymptomatic at that time, and his counts were pretty good. We reviewed his marrow. We considered it to be more consistent with chronic myelomonocytic leukemia 2 in the marrow, although he didn't have the peripheral blood monocytosis to match that. At any rate, he was very interested in being treated aggressively. Counts at that time showed a white count of 4.2, hemoglobin of 13.5. Platelets were 75,000. That was a little less than when he had presented. So that was really the only hematologic problem he had. And this is the patient that I had mentioned where we looked at a WPSS score, and I believe it was in the high-risk category, and the IPSS-R put him into an intermediate-risk category, something like that. He had normal karyotype, but we did do a next-gen panel, next-gen sequencing panel for typical myeloid genes, and in fact, he was found to have 4 abnormalities out of the ones that were tested, an abnormality in IDH2, SRSF2, which is commonly, it's a splicing mutation, commonly mutated in MDS, RUNX1 and ASXL1. And the latter two, ASXL1 and RUNX1, are both negative prognostic mutations, unfortunately. So that gets to the point that I was trying to make before, that in his case, where there was a discrepancy between the two scoring systems, I think the truth there is in his mutations, which show you that he's going to be a bad actor, his disease is going to be a bad actor. But he was totally well, and he kind of wanted to get a few more months of work under his belt, and I saw no reason not to, given that our plan was to treat him and then get him to stem cell transplant. I mentioned that for people with high-risk MDS, early application of azo nucleosides is probably associated with improved survival, but given that we're going to be giving him the ultimate disease modifier anyway, which is stem cell transplant, I don't really think that that was so germane. So back in November, we were getting ready to enroll him on a clinical trial that we were planning to start in December, and unfortunately, his disease had progressed again to more advanced MDS that is currently categorized as acute myeloid leukemia with mild dysplastic-related changes, which made him ineligible for that trial, which was an azonucleoside-based trial. So he's currently undergoing chemotherapy on a clinical trial, cytarabine-based chemotherapy, with the hopes of getting him to a stem cell transplant following that. Unfortunately, his day 14 marrow from this current regimen is not completely clear, innate biological resistance of some of these bad-acting MDS cases, even though he's really without any side effects and I think will tolerate reinduction very well.
A couple of questions in terms of new things coming out with MDS. I see that he had an IDH2 variant. What about IDH inhibitors?
Boy, would I love to give him an IDH inhibitor. And unfortunately, there are no clinical trials of IDH inhibitors for patients like him, untreated MDS or untreated AML. And there's no compassionate use single patient IND things at all. I certainly wanted to work that angle for him. Would have been my first choice to give him azacitidine with an IDH inhibitor, I think would be a spectacular choice for him. Another thing which is coming down the pike out of ASH is that there looks to be a very positive signal for azacitidine plus venetoclax, although it's really still a phase 1/2 days. The data by Courtney DiNardo out of the MD Anderson look extremely promising. So I think that's something to keep an eye open for.
Yeah, actually, I was going to ask you about venetoclax, but just to finish out in terms of IDH inhibitors, what do we know about them? How are they administered? What kind of toxicity? What kind of efficacy? Have you used them?
Yeah. They're administered orally, and there's one which is specific to the one mutation and not the other, and there's the other drug which is active in both 1 and 2, and I can't tell you, one is AG220, I can't remember the numbers. They're orally administered. I believe they're pretty well tolerated. They're pretty active in reducing blasts and inducing differentiation, and it's my impression that complete remissions as a single agent are distinctly uncommon. But there's a lot of buzz, I think, about combining them either with conventional chemotherapy or with azanucleosides, and there's ongoing clinical trials. I think there's no doubt that they're going to show important activity and receive agency approval, and I think that's one of the reasons why the companies developing them are being very circumspect about letting anybody treat patients outside of the clinical trials, which I get that.
What fraction of patients with MDS and AML have IDH mutations?
I'm thinking about 8% of AML, and I can't give you really a number for MDS off the top of my head, but it's probably in the 8%-ish range.
And at this point, these drugs are used in the advanced setting after, what, first, second, third line therapy?
Yeah, pretty much. I believe that there may be a trial in elderly MDS of azacitidine with or without an IDH inhibitor for people with the mutation. I think it's for AML. AML with patients who are not going to be considered for cytarabine-based therapy who have IDH mutations. So they can get it first line, but younger patients not.
And of course, you mentioned venetoclax, which is now approved in CLL. And I'd heard about its use in MDS, as you said, combined with azacitidine. What do we know about single-agent activity? What's been observed in combined therapy with azacitidine?
I don't think there's a lot of positive data in single-agent venetoclax in MDS. The data out of the expansion cohort from the phase 1 trial of AZA plus venetoclax suggests something like a 60% CR rate. I may be misquoting, but it's one of these, you know, small, highly selected studies. So, you know, I'll be thrilled to death if that's the case. But, you know, even if it's 40%, if it's, you know, any CRs in MDS is a spectacular outcome because, as you know, Neil, the CR rate for azacitidine alone is about 12%.
Yeah, I mean, venetoclax, I've been hearing in some strange situations I never expected. Myeloma, I've heard about it in mantle cell.
Yeah.
And another thing that sort of seems to cross tumor lines that you hear about in various situations are checkpoint inhibitors. And I've heard about also those in MDS, again, with hypomethylating agent. What do we know about anti-PD-1 antibodies, PD-L1 antibodies?
Well, this is really complicated, Neil. So we've only just started hearing data about the checkpoint inhibitors in MDS, and it's pretty clear that there's not a robust signal in monotherapy. There certainly have been some responses to CTLA-4 antibodies, ipilimumab, but they're not terribly robust, and neither are they very common. I'm not sure anybody has any robust responses to either nivolumab or pembrolizumab as single therapies, single agent therapies. There are now trials, a lot of trials, looking at AZA with or without the PD-1 and the PD-L1 antibodies. I've recently seen data from an MD Anderson study of AZA plus nivolumab, which I believe they've presented at ASH, so it's in the public domain. And what I took home from it, first of all, was there was a significant amount of pneumonitis, about 15% of patients. That was reassuring to me because we're participating in a study of azacitidine with one of the PD-L1 inhibitors, and we've seen some pulmonary problems which we can't exclude from being pneumonitis. It's a very difficult population to make that assessment in, obviously, because these are patients who get pneumonia anyway, Neil. You know, they're neutropenic to start with, and you're giving them azacitidine, so pneumonia would not be uncommon. They're thrombocytopenic, so you can't do a good lung biopsy. So you try to manage them conservatively, but at a certain point, you got to say, gee, this could be the PD-L1 inhibitor, the PD-1 inhibitor, and you're going to be obliged to give steroids.
Yeah, actually, I've talked to your colleague Roy Herbst and Sarah Goldberg. This is a huge problem with lung cancer also.
Right, but they can at least do biopsies and make the diagnosis.
Right, right.
So interestingly, again, anecdotally, and I can't tell you what drug they're getting because they're on a clinical trial which I can't divulge the identity of, but a patient with AML, I believe, who got azacitidine plus one of these inhibitors, again, in their first cycle, developed this pretty severe pulmonary complication, bringing her to the intensive care unit, fortunately not requiring intubation, but we, of course, gave her steroids. She developed a complete response. She continued to get azacitidine alone. She got only one cycle of the checkpoint inhibitor, and she developed a complete remission. Again, it's just a little anecdote, but it's hard to not be intrigued because the number of AZA complete responses we see otherwise is pretty small, so who knows?
Yeah, again, you see this story coming up with other cancers where when you use combined therapy, you can never necessarily figure out what's going on, although this lady sounds like she did a lot better than you might expect on AZA alone.
Exactly. And of course, that's why it's important that these patients are on randomized trials. You know, so I really give these companies kudos for doing things the right way, even though it's sometimes frustrating to us and the patients when they get randomized to standard of care.
What kinds of trials right now are ongoing looking at checkpoint inhibitors in MDS?
You know, take your pick. I'm sure there's trials with both azacitidine and decitabine. There's trials in combination with nivolumab, pembrolizumab, atezolizumab, durvalumab. Those are ones that come to mind right away in my mind. I'm sure there's probably others as well.
So I think we could probably talk about one more of your cases. Why don't we try to do four?
So this patient is a patient we actually haven't treated yet, but he's a wonderful guy referred from the Veterans Hospital who's been anemic for some time and otherwise reasonably healthy with some probably underlying cardiovascular disease for which he's been stented. And he was found to have refractory anemia with ring sideroblasts now several years ago. And he was appropriately treated with a very good dose of an erythropoietic stimulating agent, darbepoetin. And again, just to remind our audience, the doses of the erythropoietic stimulating agents, which are effective in patients with MDS, is much higher than standard doses they're probably used to using for other indications. So for darbepoetin, the doses which have been best studied are either 300 micrograms weekly or 500 biweekly. So much, much higher than the usual doses that are administered in other anemic patients in solid tumor malignancy. So he was given a very good dose of darbepoetin. At some point, G-CSF was added to his regimen, as I mentioned earlier, with erythropoietin. Refractory anemia with ring sideroblast patients only respond in general if G-CSF is added. And for reasons we don't really totally understand, it's not really clear that G-CSF has any benefit to darbepoetin. And it's also possible that you'd get responses to erythropoietin if you push the dose even higher. So it may really be a dose effect. But anyway, he got no extra benefit from the addition of G-CSF. And he's now in a regular transfusion program, really quite healthy. The exciting news for this patient is an upcoming drug, which looks extremely active for these patients, luspatercept. There's actually two drugs that are very similar. One is called sotatercept. One is called luspatercept. They're both serve as sponges for TGF-beta and similar ligands, which are negative regulators of erythropoiesis. So basically, the protein circulates around and sucks up all the TGF-beta and SMAD molecules and seems to act like a super-duper erythropoietin for these patients. Why they're active, particularly in patients with refractory anemia with ring sideroblasts and other sideroblastic MDS patients, is totally unclear. And it was discovered sort of incidentally in the early clinical trials of both drugs that patients who either had excess numbers of ring sideroblasts or the molecular equivalent, which is mutations in SF3B1 or SRSF2, these patients seem to have a very high rate of profound erythroid response. So the trial that this patient is waiting to go on, I think it may be because he's in Florida or something and doesn't want to be treated right now, is a randomized trial of luspatercept versus placebo. And I think it's a 2-to-1 randomization for luspatercept. So it's, again, it's unfortunate that there's no crossover at any point. But we do have at least one patient that we've seen who is seems to have an improvement in hemoglobin in response to something that he's getting in such a trial. So we're pretty excited about that. We expect that this drug is going to be successful and hopefully get FDA approval for these patients.
When I hear SEP, I think about aflibercept, which I think is like a fusion protein or something. Is that what this is?
Yeah, so luspatercept, it is a fusion protein. And I don't remember the details, Neil.
But it sucks up TGF-beta.
Yeah, basically. It's got some FAB fragments of something attached to something else. So I actually haven't given it myself yet, but it's pretty exciting. Actually, quite interestingly, Neil, the drug sotatercept they were being developed in parallel. So sotatercept in the U.S., luspatercept in Europe, and they chose luspatercept to move forward with. But when I was leaving Johns Hopkins 3 years ago, we had just opened up a sotatercept trial, and I had a patient who was Jehovah's Witness, really devout Jehovah's Witness, who came to me profoundly anemic with low-grade MDS, and he had a 5Q minus, actually. And I bit the bullet and gave him lenalidomide back in the day and watched his hemoglobin drop initially quite profoundly. And people thought I was crazy because his hemoglobin got down to like less than 5. But then he had a robust response, which lasted quite a long time, eventually breaking through. And my colleague who picked up my patients, Amy Dezern, was able to enroll him on this trial of sotatercept. And he had a spectacularly good response that lasted quite a long time. So this is a nice story. He eventually did succumb to his disease because he remained a devout witness and unfortunately died of anemia, but pretty exciting.
It's fascinating. What is your experience with Jehovah's Witnesses, and how do you send them to special centers, or you treat them yourself? Do you have a center?
Well, no. I mean, there's not a lot we can do for them, honestly. If they have high-risk MDS, there's very little one can do. In low-risk MDS, again, you try to do your best. You hope that their EPO level is low, their erythropoietin level is low, and you ride out the erythropoietic stimulating agents. I think most Jehovah's Witnesses are happy to take ESAs. I think that's not prescribed. If they have a 5Q minus, or even if they don't, you know, you certainly can try lenalidomide. But after that, you know, it's pretty tough.
I want to go on, and maybe we can just briefly talk about your fifth case, but I wanted to ask you, I meant to ask you before, what's new in terms of oral hypomethylating agents, particularly azacitidine?
Yeah, so I have a lot of experience with oral azacitidine. I've been involved with those studies since the early phase 1 days. And clearly oral azacitidine is active. It's quite active. I think there's disagreements among authorities who've looked at the data as to whether the schedules of oral azacitidine, which are being developed, are more active than parenteral 7-day azacitidine. Theoretically, there's reasons to think that it might be, because giving lower doses of an azanucleoside for longer has the potential for getting the nucleoside incorporated into more cells that may be cycling slowly and not inhibiting cell cycle. So giving the drug, of which the plasma concentrations which are achieved are lower than with parenteral, so you're getting lower doses, and giving it daily for 14 days or 21 days may in fact be a better way to give the drug. So oral azacitidine is quite active. It's in the middle of a long, aborting phase 3 trial that's very difficult to accrue to because it's targeting a very narrow slice of low-risk patients with high-risk features. So they have to be low-risk patients but have to have thrombocytopenia and anemia, and it's a really tough needle to thread. And it's a placebo-controlled trial, so that's a tough registration trial. I believe it's about halfway accrued. There's oral decitabine as well, which is being developed with tetrahydrouridine, which inhibits cytidine deaminase. And I don't know a lot about it. I think it's moving along pretty fast. And I think there's a trial done in Asia in elderly AML, which accrued, I think it's done accruing 300-some patients with oral decitabine. I believe I'm correct about that. Interestingly, Neil, you know, the doses of azacitidine, which ended up being studied in MDS starting in the late 80s by Lou Silverman and Jimmy Holland, really came from phase 1 studies done at Johns Hopkins in sickle cell anemia, published in Blood in 1983 or 4 by George Dover and Sam Shirash. And the way we did phase 1 trials in that paper back in those days was that there were 3 patients who each received azacitidine in a variety of different schedules. It was really pretty crazy. But one of the schedules that was given was oral azacitidine to swallow the stuff. And it was effective in sickle cell anemia back there in 1984. So it's back to the future.
Would you like to use it right now? Or do you think you need more data before you want to use it?
I would have used it 7 years ago. And I had certainly thought that one registration approach, which I would have been happy with, would have been to do a straightforward randomized phase 2 thing between the oral AZA and the parenteral AZA and just show that there was clinical equivalence. And I believe that it could have been FDA approved, in my opinion, a long time ago. But that was not the strategy that was chosen.
So let's finish out and hear about your fifth case.
Yeah, so this patient is one of my favorite patients. He's a crotchety older guy, salt of the earth, blue-collar, Connecticut, Waterbury guy, a heavy smoker, and on routine exam was found to have an abnormal CBC. He had been treated for prostate cancer with radiation therapy and hormonal intervention, developed macrocytosis and pancytopenia, And at that time, bone marrow was performed. This is now in 2014. And he had 25% blasts, actually, with myelodysplastic syndrome-associated features. So in the old days, we would have called that REEBT, refractory anemia excess blasts and transformation. We now call that AML with myelodysplastic syndrome-related changes. I believe he had normal cytogenetics. He has a history of diabetes and history of kidney stones, a lot of urologic-related problems. Hemoglobin was about in the sevens, I believe, and he received azacitidine, and it looked like he wasn't going to respond. We know that it takes up to 6 or even 12 cycles sometimes to respond. I usually personally don't continue after 6 if there's no evidence of response, but our data does show that there are some late responders. But we know that our best responders, you often see improvement after 1 or 2 cycles. Anyway, he got to cycle 5, and at cycle 5, he doubled his platelet count up to 150,000. So that was the first glimmer. Platelet response is often your first signal that somebody's going to respond. And then he ended up having a spectacular response to azacitidine, really probably a complete response with trilineage normalization. He was happy as a clam. I mean, just robust lifestyle. He loves to go to one of the casinos out in eastern Connecticut. That's what he does with his senior group and his wife, who's a survivor of severe Guillain-Barré syndrome. They're a lovely couple and just had a great lifestyle. And he'd complain about coming in for his shots once a month, but did it with some pretty good humor. But eventually, as often happens after about a year, his count started trickling down and, you know, you start to lower your dose and you spread out the AZA, and it's pretty clear that he's breaking through the AZA. And in fact, his bone marrow showed recurrence of leukemia, again with about 30% blasts now. Still cytogenetically normal. And again, we sent off a next-gen sequencing panel, which I'm not sure we had done before. And he had several mutations, including IDH2, SRSF2, DNMT3A, and WT1, as well as RUNX1. So, sad thing about this patient is he entered a clinical trial of your choice of best conventional care versus the IDH2 inhibitor and was randomized to the control arm. And it was a 2-to-1 randomization. He 70% chance of getting the IDH2 inhibitor, which I think really would benefit him. But in fact, he's in palliative care right now.
Wow. Interesting.
We can't move fast enough with some of these drugs.
Have we learned anything about identifying patients who have these kinds of responses to hypomethylating agents?
Boy, you know, that was the bane of my, has been the bane of my research for the last 15 plus years. And we're really not that close. We know that people who have TET2 mutations probably have a higher rate of response, but it's not, if you don't have a TET2 mutation, there's still a 40% chance of having a response, so it's not really a good discriminating factor. We know the patients with P53 mutations are as likely to respond as people who don't, so they're no less likely to respond to P53 mutations, whereas the patients with P53 mutations will likely not respond to cytarabine-based therapy, so that's important, but their responses to azanucleosides is not long-lived. So if you get a good response in a P53 mutated patient, you want to take them to transplant. Although, as I've mentioned, their outcome with transplant is also inferior to patients who don't have a P53 mutation. So no, azanucleosides remain a bit of a mystery. And we continue to do, you know, really heavy-duty integrative analysis of the epigenome and the transcriptome to try to see if we can, in multidimensional space, identify, you know, those patients who are responding. Not so much because, although it'll be useful to select patients, but really to be able to identify the targets that we're treating so that we can come up with targeted agents and not go through 6 cycles of whatever. You know, if we can really figure out what it is we're turning on and off, that's really what we need to do and make better drugs targeting those abnormalities.
This concludes our program. Special thanks to our faculty, and thank you for listening. This is Dr. Neil Love for MDS Update.